Welcome in, second hour, Robbie and Rexo here, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. I'm Joe Rexo, Jake Lyman in for Robbie Stanley, Ian Safar producing. And we're very happy to welcome in our next guest who has been out there and will be out there. Get the you know, this guy wears pants out there. And I remember that he gave me a good explanation. I think it's probably a sun avoidance, but we can ask him right here. Nick Suss of the Tennessean, Titans beat writer. Remind me, Nick, why you wear pants when it's 98 degrees and blazing hot sun covering a team doing training camp?
Because I have respect for the job, Joe.
That's a good answer. Are you going tuxedo this year?
I am getting in the car right now with top hat and tails.
Wow.
Are fully ready for the most formal of training camps in this league.
I think you're going to command a lot of respect out there, you know? Carson's going to be out there in his little tank top and his baseball cap, and you're just going to outclass him big time. You told me a reason at one point, and I forgot. And it was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, some of it's sun protection, and some of it's just like, I don't know if I own a reasonably lengthed pair of shorts, and we don't need to get into my specific insecurities, but like, I don't know what the acceptable length of covering the knee above the knee is generationally acceptable at a work event. And so I'm like, I'm just going to wear pants. It's not worth it.
I say go with like the real baggy cargo shorts, like when I was young. Those, I think those are still cool, you know. So, but yes, you're right. Like, I mean, actually, I'm wearing a pair of shorts right now because my wife buys me all my clothes. But they're actually pretty tight, and they're like pretty high up on my leg. You know, I guess that's the cool thing, huh? That's what the cool kids are doing.
If I knew what was cool, Joe, I'd be in a different industry. But as somebody who's trying to represent at least some modicum of cool, I'll wear a pair of jeans today, and then I'll observe, and if there's a pair of shorts that I'm like, oh, I can pull that off, I'll go to the store and spend $14 or whatever, but that's the most.
All right, so, see, a frugal shopper too. I like that a lot. All right, listen, before we get into camp and yesterday's presser and what's coming and all that, I did want to talk about, Nick, about your story. I thought you did a great job on the first-round quarterbacks of the Super Bowl era trying to lay out like what has worked, what hasn't worked, et cetera. We talked about it at length when it came out on the show, but I want to ask you, anything in there really surprise you? I was a bit surprised by a few things. As you went through it, what was most surprising to you or what struck you the most?
I mean, the most surprising thing is just how much doesn't matter. Like, we can get into the stuff that does matter, and I think that that's really, really valuable and worth talking about. But just fundamentally, the lack of correlation between production and future success is kind of startling. We know it's a bottom-line industry. We know that wins and losses matter most. We know that continuity matters most. But the fact that I could not find any modicum of connection between how many touchdowns you throw or how many yards you throw for or how often you're sacked, which I thought would be a huge one. The fact that none of this seems to be at all strongly correlated to quarterback success really made me sit back and reevaluate what it is we need to be looking for in year one with Cam Ward and what it is we need to be looking for with rookie quarterbacks in general. Because if the lesson here isn't go throw a bunch of touchdowns or go try not to throw interceptions or protect the quarterback, if the lesson is purely, hey, give him some continuity and let him learn from his mistakes, then we might be looking at this entire endeavor the wrong way.
Yeah, well, and I definitely got a little more from the whole thing, and this is not, of course, nothing's true across the board. There are always exceptions, but it seems, Nick, like, look, if you are one of those guys, you're probably going to find your way, even if you're in a bad spot. And I think that more than I did before after reading this.
Yeah, it's the thing of like the self-selecting bias of the quarterbacks who start week one are more likely to be successful than the quarterbacks who don't start week one. But the quarterbacks who start week one are the guys who people think are the best already. So we're kind of saying the, well, if we think you're good, you're going to be good situation. So I don't know too much that we can learn from the self-selection of the eyeball test already works. But I do think that when we looked at the, I'm saying we, I did it myself, when I looked at all of this data and saw just how likely the tier one guys, the best of the best, were to have experienced continuity year one to year two, and how likely those tier four guys weren't to have experienced continuity year one to year two, that did startle me a little bit. That, look, sometimes it's as simple as don't knock a quarterback off track if they're heading into year two. But you also have to make the decision, okay, are we building the entire franchise off of a quarterback's confidence, or do we want to actually go get a coach who we think will be able to be here long term? And it's such a juggling act, but if that's the one thing that does seem to consistently play out, where you move off of a coach after year one of a quarterback, you're going to set him back a year or two, and it's probably going to end up, by the time his rookie contract's up, he's not where you want him to be, that does startle me a little bit.
Talking with Nick Suss from the Tennessean here on Robbie and Rex Road. Speaking of Cam Ward, starting off his first training camp today, and no Will Levis now this season, how much does that change for Cam Ward? Obviously going to get the lion's share, if not all of the first team reps now, but maybe not as much competition and pressure in that room too. How much does the Levis decision change how Cam Ward's first training camp's going to look?
I mean, it shouldn't really change anything. I might question whether it changes stuff about how he handles the preseason, of just specifically who's playing and what reps in the games. But practice-wise, I don't think that there was any expectation that there would be much of a rotation, that there would be much of a true one-for-one top-team reps competition situation. Like, this isn't to say Levis was not going to participate at all. Obviously, it's going to change how Brandon Allen and Tim Boyle take their reps, but you got to keep the long view here. And even if the short view is that we were going to go through another week or two of a little bit more rotation at the top, the long view is that Cam Ward wasn't drafted to be anything but the Titans' starter of the present and future. So that is still the case. And while it is a bummer that Will not be out there, because it's fun to watch a guy who can throw a ball really hard and really far in practice, it's very interesting, and I think that him in year two in a system is something that he'd never experienced before, and it would have been fun to see, but obviously the decision's been made, and now the focus can entirely be on Cam, with less focus on the sideshow about announcing a starter and that sort of thing.
Coming out of the press conference yesterday, we learned a little bit more about the Legarius Sneed saga and what's healthy, what he's coming back from. What are your thoughts on what Sneed could be for this team this year? Is there an expectation that he's going to get healthy and he can be the number one cornerback for this team, or is that more wishful thinking as he starts camp on the pup list?
I kind of frame it based off of the converse look of what does he mean to the team rather than what could he mean. Of, look, this defense is set up for aggressive cornerbacks to be the thing that make it go. You didn't go out and spend a bunch of money on pass rushers. With Lorenzo Carter retiring, I don't think that was much of a pass rusher help either. He was one of the league's least productive pass rushers last year, but still, that's another hit to that room. So you're looking at a team that, if you're not making pressure off the edge and you're collapsing the pocket from the interior, the cornerback play on the outside is going to need to be sticky to take there longer, since the quick pressures aren't going to be happening as much. And they're going to need to be the ones making the havoc plays if you're not going to have as many opportunities for strip sacks and negative plays off the edge. So, in theory, if you have Sneed and McCreary and Brownlee all playing at the same time, and that's three aggressive downhill types of corner, you can make this defense run without a dominant pass rush. But if you don't have that dominant pass rush and you're missing one of your aggressive sticky corners, you get into a situation where you ask, what does this defense do to make opposing offenses struggle? And I don't know if an interior pass rush is enough for that. I don't know if good defensive tackle play can singularly make a defense create the big plays it needs to turn the ball over and create negative plays and that sort of thing. So if Sneed's healthy, frankly, who the heck knows? We've seen him play 4 or 5 times in a Titans uniform and practice maybe 10 times in a Titans uniform. I need to see it before I can say anything about it. But if he's there, I have a feeling this defense can possibly work. If he's not there, I'm going to need a lot of convincing that this defense can function the way it needs to.
Last thing for you, Nick. You know, one of the things, like you said earlier, Levis, it's like, you know, it's fun to like watch someone who can throw the ball, has some arm talent, might get a ball in the water, perhaps on the bounce, you know, during camp. That's all out. Also, I figured we'd see like full, like halves of these preseason games with Levis, and that would have been interesting, and maybe that leads to a deal or whatever. So we know, you know, I think this clears things up in terms of reps. Obviously, you take a quarterback out of the situation in practice. What about preseason games in Cam Ward? Do you think, do you get a sense, do you feel, and what do you think they should do in terms of how much they should play him in those games to get him ready for the season?
Get a feel. I probably want to see these practices and talk to some more people before they know how ready he is. I think that they need to experience that before we can guess on it, but my judgment, I'd like to see him play a couple of series in two of them and maybe a half in one of them. You don't want to expose him to too much, and you know that this is bland offensive scheming, so it's not necessarily about commanding the offense, but I want to see him react to the speed of the game and to having rushers in his face, and really the only time you're going to get that is in the preseason. So that's the biggest checkbox for me this entire preseason, and maybe I'm unique in this regard, so I'm probably valuing the preseason games a little bit too much, but I know how good he is at throwing the football against air, and I know how good he is at talking and rallying his teammates and all the stuff that's the rah-rah side. The one thing I don't know is how he's going to react to playing full-speed NFL football, and so the more opportunity he has to do that, even if that means playing a full half in Atlanta or something like that, I welcome it.
Nick Suss from the Tennessean. Thank you very much, sir. Titans beat writer. Have fun today. Sweat it out in style, my brother. Enjoy it out there.
I'm going to try to. Thank you, guys.
All right. Nick Suss from the Tennessean right there. When we come back, we will react to some of that and get a little bit into that idea of Cam Ward and seeing live NFL pass rush. Robbie and Rex Show, 102.5, 106.3 The Game. Oh, yeah. Tune in to ESPN 94.9 The Fan today as the Nashville Sounds take on Charlotte at First Horizon Park. Pre-game begins at 6:20 p.m., first pitch at 6:35. Coverage also available on the Game Nashville app and at thegamenashville.com. Sounds Baseball on ESPN 94.9 Fan, presented by Twin Peaks and Family Leisure. Let that Black Sabbath fill your ears. Dude, someone – dude, listen to Ozzy. Rest in peace, Ozzy. George on the YouTube chat says the Titans played War Pigs for every kickoff last season. Horrible song gets nobody hyped, George. Horrible song. Look, I don't know if it, I don't know if War Pigs is a kickoff song necessarily. Actually, the Vols though, Tennessee played War Pigs. I don't remember if it was like it was a big game, and I remember it. And they did like the late like not laser, but they did like the light show thing, and it was pretty awesome. It wasn't kickoff, so I don't know if it's a kickoff song, but horrible song. That is the worst take of the day. We've had some doozies already, George. Also, on the music front, I'm still waiting to hear from anybody who went to Coldplay last night. Like, apparently people paid $8 million to go to Coldplay. Somebody out there who's listening must have gone to Coldplay. I need information on the show.
Nevada Josh on the text line says, Will Levis was at Coldplay with his side piece Liam Cohen trying to work out a new deal with the Jags.
Ah,
Duval.
At first I was like, "Hey, really?" Okay, it's a joke about Liam Cohen. All right, thank you. I mean, seriously, who actually was there? Someone must have been there. I do want to read this text, Josh. You know what? You know what else I want to do though? Before that, you know what I want to do? I want to give away these pair of tickets to see Ghost. Since we're on a music kick right now, Ghost, Bridgestone Arena this Saturday. Caller, what do you think, Ian? How about caller 4?
4 sounds good.
Caller 4 to get those tickets to Ghost Saturday at Bridgestone. But I want to read this text. This is maybe this is a little bit of a, you know, wake-up call for Titans fans. Quote, this message is for all the whiny, sad, crybaby-ass Titans fans who hate all these guys in charge, all the players suck, the organization's bad, and blah, blah. You're supposed to be fans, not haters, A lot has changed since last year. Let's at least watch some football before you lay down and curl up and get whooped, because these players ain't going to do that. Let's give them some love and hope and optimism before hate, and let's tighten the fart up. Thank you. Thank you for that text. You know what? It's good to hear something like that every once in a while. It is nothing but negativity. And look, it's nothing but reality. They're not good. But this is the time of year when you're supposed to talk yourself into something positive about your football team, right?
There's supposed to be hope at this time of year. And I understand that the Titans roster, it's just not very good. And they're probably not going to be contending for anything meaningful this year. But I like the texter's message. Let's be a little bit optimistic before we even spot the ball and start playing football.
Yeah, let's let them prove that they suck before you know for sure, all right? Jackson on the text line, driven by WilsonCountyHunter.com, 615-737-1025, says, Titans used to play Crazy Train back in the day before the opening kickoff. That was awesome. Should bring that back. Okay. Yeah, I think Crazy Train, although War Pigs I think is a much better song, I think Crazy Train might be a better kickoff song.
Yeah. I will say anything's better than – didn't they play Swag Surfing for like 2 straight years before every single kickoff? That was horrible.
I think that's right. Another, like John Glenn and I used to always sit in the press box, and I love Johnny Cash. But the Johnny Cash song that they played going into the fourth, it's not Ring of Fire.
Well, I was going to say the Ring of Fire after the touchdowns is horrible too.
But the one they played going into the fourth quarter is like – you know, it was always like, oh, man, everybody's getting pumped up now.
Folsom Prison Blues.
Yes. It's like, oh, yeah, everybody's on fire. That's just not the right timing. Keith says, fart, George. Rest in power, Ozzy. I am heartbroken. So, yeah, I mean, calling War Pigs a horrible song, my God, that is an atrocious take. Okay, so Cam Ward, preseason games. What are you doing if you're in charge? You're coaching this team. What are you doing with Cam Ward in preseason games?
I think you're doing the 2 joint practices. I don't know how much you actually need to see him in the preseason games. Honestly, if he gets all...
There's still no taking to the ground in the joint practices.
That's true.
And that does change your... Now, that adds the risk. But it also still changes, like, mentally, you know you're not being taken to the ground in joint practices.
That's a good point. I think if I'm the head coach and I'm sorting this out, I say Cam Ward gets as many reps as possible in those joint practices. He doesn't play at all in the, would it be the Falcons game is first?
Is it?
Falcons, then Tampa Bucks, or
Bay?
Bucks, then Falcons.
I thought it was Tampa Bay, then Falcons.
Whichever the first.
Tampa is first.
Tampa,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't play him at all against Tampa. Then maybe 2 series against the Falcons.
And then Minnesota.
And then Minnesota at home. I'd probably say give him a quarter and a half.
You're telling me that you would force people to watch Brandon Allen and Tim Boyle quarterback the entire preseason
Boyle.
Game?
Correct.
Oh, what, Boyle rules. No. No, it would probably just be Boyle. I don't know how much. I guess the backup
just
gets
all
some.
Tim Boyle?
Probably in the preseason.
Bring in.
You got to play your backup, right?
I guess.
Bring in some undrafted rookie.
Just stop preseason games.
He can play the fourth
quarter. It's not worth the injury risk.
Man. Yeah, I if you have 2 joint practices, Cam Ward doesn't need to play a ton in the preseason. I think he needs to play some. Like, you don't do the Tannehill and just put him on the shelf until regular season games start.
No, I agree. Like, you have to play some. I mean, look, there's risk, but
like,
it's still not the same thing as a regular season game, and I think you have to find some things out, and you have to – I mean, it's a chance to get him better, right?
Yeah. I think you need to see him in the preseason – a decent amount, more than you would probably next year, obviously. Like,
once he's established, and you just ice him.
But
see you on September 4th or whatever.
Like, Nick saying a half in the last game of the preseason, like, they used to do that. That was what it used to be, the third preseason game. You'd see the starters out there for close to the entire first half. I don't know about that. I would say play him the first quarter if you feel good about the first quarter. Then bench him. If he needs one more drive to get the confidence up heading into the regular season, you throw him out there again. But I wouldn't say he needs to play more than 3 series in any given preseason game.
Okay. Texter says, I don't need to wait and see anything. With Callahan as head coach, I know they will be garbage. So there we go. A quick rebuke there of the positivity. Jackson says, we're not getting any Coldplay, but we got a lot of stadium music in for me. He says they used to Nissan Stadium used to play Give It Away by Red Hot Chili Peppers after the opposing team turned it over. Good. And Beck's Loser when the opposing team ran out of the tunnel. Those are
appropriate. Right up your alley, Joe.
I love both of those things. So there you go. A lot of people, Caleb says, if they have any other QBs at all on the roster, they got to sign someone to get through the preseason. Mike Borgonzi said yesterday they probably aren't. I mean, they have three arms. You know, a fourth arm is fine. I think it's Cam, Brandon Allen, and Tim Boyle. Maybe they'll sign a fourth guy, but I don't think they necessarily will.
I mean,
it sounded like they're not planning on it.
If you wanted to sign a depth guy who's undrafted free agent who just comes in and he can be your mop-up guy in the fourth quarter of a preseason game, that's fine.
Yeah.
But nobody who's going to legitimately get any meaningful reps is going to come in at this point, I don't think.
When we come back, I have to yell at, I think we might be the dumbest person for it. I think we may actually have, it's almost like back-to-back rants coming up. Robbie and Rex are 102.5, 106 through the game. I mean, I'm just going to let this one play too. But I will tell you, Paranoid by Black Sabbath, great jam. But I also will tell you that this September, Tim McGraw will be performing at Trinitix's Rock the Cradle in Nashville, a meaningful event supporting newborns and moms at Ascension St. Thomas Midtown. Get your tickets now at rockthecradlenashville.org. Great song. This was, there you go. Turn it back up. This song, as featured in Dazed and Confused, too, you know.
Might be the best soundtrack of any movie.
Might be.
It's up there.
Might be.
Yeah.
And this was like part where they were like, going out to the moon tower, right?
Oh, yeah. Kegger at the moon tower.
Full kegs of the moon tower. So there you go. Welcome back in, Robbie and Rex Show. We're going to take a quick detour here because I just have to address Big Ten Commissioner Tony Petitti, who hilariously to me, and I did write a column about this at The Athletic, but hilariously to me in Las Vegas yesterday, Big Ten Media Days in Las Vegas.
In Vegas.
Yeah, sure. Like, everybody has their Media Days in Vegas now. They just rotate. He is doubling down on this horrific college football playoff expansion plan. And the thing is, he's not even – he actually is separating it. He's kind of, in the past, has framed it. And first of all, when I say in the past, he did one podcast with Joel Klatt. This is the first time he's talked publicly. I give him credit for standing up there in front of all the reporters – and doubling down and giving it a try, okay? I give him credit for that. But he's kind of even separated it from, it kind of has been framed, if the SEC goes to 9 games, okay, then we'll, you know, like basically we'll back away and do the common sense thing, which is if they go to 16, you have 5 automatic bids for conference champions, and then everyone else is an at-large bid that is selected based on a committee that looks at all the factors. These goobers in the Big Ten want 4 for the Big Ten and 4 for the SEC and 2 for the Big 12 and 2 for the ACC, and they want to rig the playoff. They want, because for reasons, because we have more money, just because we just deserve it, just because we're the Big Ten and the SEC. Now, again, the SEC, thank goodness, is now on the other side, and they better not change. And I think Greg Sankey last week made it clear they're not changing. I mean, they don't agree with this. There and the SEC shouldn't agree with this, because more at-large bids and not letting the Big Ten get 4, and really the Big Ten and the Big 12 and ACC aren't necessarily going to get 2 every year either. You're better off if you're the SEC saying, you know what, let's go ahead and ride this out. Last year in a 16-team playoff, the SEC gets 6. But Tony Petitti is making his case, and it's total spin, right? It's like, he never addresses why you should have more if you're the Big Ten. He never addresses why you should have more if you're the SEC. Just, you know, we need to take it out of the committee's hands. Some people are – that appeals to people. I want – this should be – results on the field should matter, not a committee. But then, of course, the answer is, so the results in your standings, in your 18-team league with league schedules that are completely all over the damn map, that's what should matter? He also said, quote, let's better connect the regular season and the postseason, end quote. He wants these gimmicky, goofball play-in games as part of championship weekend. So this plan, for anybody who hasn't heard me rail about it, I'm going to do it one more time. You know, you have a championship game, but then you also have your 3 and your 6 will play, and your 4 and your 5 will play. And the winners of those two games get the automatic bids, just as the two teams in the championship game are just they're in. It's first of all, if it doesn't sound stupid, let's go back to last year. Indiana was the three. Indiana was the surprise story of college football. Indiana got in. People were mad. I think they should have, but there was a case to be made for some of those three lost SEC teams. It was very close. This has made everybody overreact to all this stuff. But Indiana, according to this plan, is in a one-game playoff to get in the playoff with Iowa. 8-4 Iowa. 6-3 in the Big Ten. Played nobody except Ohio State and lost by 28. Lost by 12 to a bad Michigan State team. Lost to a bad UCLA team. The best thing Iowa did, they lost in the non-league to Iowa State, their rival. This team would be one win away from a locked-in playoff spot and no sorry SEC team that's 10-2, but you're behind everybody, or 9-3. Sorry, Big 12 team. Whatever. I promise you, there will be teams more deserving than Iowa of last year to get in, and Iowa could have beaten Indiana in one game, sure. The best thing they did last year, they beat Minnesota and Nebraska. Those are their big – and this is seriously what Tony Petitti said. Quote, if you're 6-3 in the Big Ten, I would argue that's a great record. And if you stumbled in a non-conference game, I don't know why that disqualifies you, end quote. Like, if anyone listened to him yesterday and has been following along and still thinks that they should go to this, I don't know what to say anymore. Like, my head's going to explode. It's just – so I want to thank Tony Petitti for actually telling everybody why it's a terrible idea.
I have never understood why anyone would go for the 4-4-2-2 model. First of all, it makes the conference championships just completely meaningless. I mean – for the most part, if it's a 16-team playoff, you can assume that both teams playing are going to get in. But
right. You'd
like the auto bid. With this system, the conference championship game doesn't matter. All it can do is injure your players. It's like, yeah, I'd like to put up a banner that says I was a Big Ten champion, but the eventual goal for those teams playing in that game is to win a national championship. And he says he wants to take it out of the committee's hands. The committee already ranks 25 teams every week. Like, the rankings are already – they're doing the work anyway. So what's the difference of having the top 16 get in or the top 12 get in? It's the exact same process. You just add four more teams on. I think it works pretty well. Obviously, they worked out the kink this year of the seeding, which – having the auto bids for the conference champions was horrible, and we saw that last year. Although Arizona State – they gave Texas all they could handle, but Boise State getting a bye over a team like Penn State or Texas, that shouldn't happen.
Right. Yeah, they fixed that, and they should have.
But I think it's the 5-plus-whatever model is the perfect way to do it. We have 5-7 now. If you go to 14, it's 5-9, then 5-11. That's how it should be, and there's a reason the Big Ten is the only conference that's really advocating for this, because they're the only conference that this legitimately will help. Because most years, I would argue that 4 is probably the right number for the Big Ten,
right?
Give or take one.
I agree. There will be years when they may only have 3 that should be in. There will be years when they'll have 6. I mean, look, like USC can come back and
Washington.
They have some programs, but if you compare the upside and the quality and just the resources and everything, the profiles of their top programs versus the SEC, the SEC is much deeper.
Yeah, year to
the
year.
The SEC is much better.
Like, over time, the 6th best team in the SEC is head and shoulders better than the 6th best team in the Big Ten.
Usually, yes, for sure. So, meanwhile, and, you know, Caroline and I had this argument when Jared flipped the script and had us argue on Jared versus Joe. But then you have the, you know, what will this do? Because I think we all agree we want good games in September. We want good non-league scheduling. So some of the case being made here by the Big Ten is that if you don't go to their dumb plan, that you're going to cost yourself. Ryan Day, Ohio State coach, national championship coach, who's still on the hot seat with his fans until he beats Michigan, says quote, I don't think it makes sense to keep scheduling games like Texas, which they're playing, if they don't get their way on this format. Which is, like, of all the dumb things said yesterday, I think that takes the cake, Ryan Day. So, don't, if we're 5-11, then the committee is going to look at it a whole season and is going to judge what you do. And yes, sure, the SEC is like, you, schedule strength's got to be more fine. But in the 5-11, the committee is going to judge teams on their whole body of work. So you're going to stop playing tough games when that matters, but you're going to play them once the format says all that matters is your standings. These games don't matter.
Yeah.
If you're Ohio State in this format, you it's conceivable that you could win a huge non-league game, beat Texas, you know, stumble a couple times in your league, be clearly better than, like, the team ahead of you in the standings because they had an easier schedule. But, no, I'm sorry, the standings are all that matters. It's insane. It's insane. And, again, if you get to the point in these leagues where just being in the top six and then you're going to play a playing game and, okay, then that's basically an NFL model. So guess what? The September games are the August games in the NFL. They're preseason games.
Yep, they don't matter. And
it's insane to me. I can't believe that we're actually arguing this.
Right. I don't get what Ryan Day is trying to say there, because playing a game like Texas, if you're Ohio State, you win that game, that is automatically a massive resume booster that you'll have for the entire season, even though it was in September or August. The committee is still going to look back and say, Ohio State beat Texas.
And by the way, if you lose to them in a very good game and you challenge yourself, I promise you,
the committee's not going to hold it against you.
It's a talking point every week about teams that challenge themselves in non-league. And I understand that Indiana didn't last year. And so they're 11-1. People are mad. Again, the Indiana thing that happened last year has caused people to overreact in so many ways.
Indiana got very lucky that they, outside of Ohio State, they avoided every good team in the Big Ten last year. And they won the games that they should. You do get credit for that.
And they dominated, Iowa, for example. They beat Nebraska 13-10. You know, Indiana beat them like 42-10 or whatever. I mean, they were a dominant team in a lot against mediocre teams. That did matter, too.
They won the games they're supposed to, and they did it handily. You win 11 games in a power conference, I would argue you should be in. Like, no matter, unless your strength of schedule is just abysmal, I think you should be in if you win 11 games in a power conference. But that also doesn't mean, like you said, that if you're the sixth best team in the Big Ten, that you deserve a play-in to get into the playoffs. Like, it's Iowa is
It's an 18-team league, guys. The schedules are so all over the map.
Well, and what Petitti was trying to say yesterday, 44% of the NFL gets in to the playoffs. In this system, only 10% of what it's like. Well, that's,
I mean, go back to MLB Network, man. Like, if you don't understand the difference between the NFL and, like, college football with more than 100, like, I don't know what to tell you. It's insanity.
Drinkwitz was saying that the other day, too. It's like the people who don't understand that the NFL, where the talent is so concentrated that you can have 44%
standing, should matter in the NFL.
It should matter, because even though schedules will be different, they're pretty much exactly the same. Like, there's
no comparison to the variance that you see in college football.
Right.
The good news is, I think, because of this stalemate, I think we're just going to stick at 12, which is totally fine with me.
So I guess
if we have to scream about it for a while and stick at 12, that's fine. When we come back, Rex Rant. I got more people to scream at. Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5, 106.3 The Game.
Sometimes he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed. And sometimes he's just, well, Joe.
Awkward moment, let's do it.
This is the Rex Rant, now on Robbie and Rex Road.
Mokhtar.
Olaf Berserker.
Berserker.
I can't wait for Mokhtar to play this weekend.
I like General Booty.
I think Stone Temple Pilots, and I promise I don't do drugs, but, you know, that was my first rock concert right there.
You can act like a man! Oh, that Hani Mokhtar. That Sam Porridge. You know, he really pours it on.
Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world.
And there it is. Ian Safar with some more gems here as we get into the Rex Rant. So, I want to do a little history lesson, guys, okay? Let's go to the NBA. Wilt Chamberlain, 1965, the first NBA player to make $100,000 a year. In today's money, that's a little over $1 million. In the 1979-80 NBA season, Bill Walton and Moses Malone both became the first players to get to $1 million in AAV. Today's money, it's about $4.5 million. That continued on various milestones as you went forward. Larry Bird, first guy to get $5 million a season. Magic Johnson, first guy to get $10 million a season. Fitting for those two because they basically saved the league. The NBA started in 1947. Do you know when the NBA first became profitable? Either of you. Trivia.
No idea.
90s?
Mid-80s. So it took about 40 years for the NBA to get profitable, which is freaking hilarious as we parachute in on this conversation around WNBA players wearing pay-us-what-you-owe-us t-shirts during All-Star Weekend. So right away, and the reaction, very predictable. I know that I'm indulging idiocy with this, but first of all, I can sum up some of the people screaming about this in this way. Protect women's sports! Why? So I can crap on women's sports! That's some people. But for those of you who aren't operating in bad faith and just seriously think WNBA players don't have a case to make more money, I got some facts for you, okay? They get about 9% of revenues. Should be, if you go to for most pro leagues, in the range of 50. You know, and the NFL pushing that 50, but it should be much more than 9. There is a CBA negotiation upcoming. They're gearing up. They're rallying public support. They should do well. And hell yes, they deserve it. Hell yes, they are owed it. The WNBA just secured a new media rights deal with Disney, NBC, and Amazon Prime that's worth $2.2 billion. There's two more media rights packages that can add close to $300 million. WNBA franchises in the last year have gone up nearly 200%. The average value, $269 million. Collectively, the franchises are valued at $3.5 billion. The average player salary is $148,000. I mean, I have to get Dave Portnoy on this. I mean, we ran about Dave Portnoy. Let me read a Dave Portnoy tweet about this. Quote, I see lots of morons trying to act like WNBA players don't deserve more money. They're throwing around the lost $50 million number that nobody even knows where it came from. It's a really long, long tweet. Continuing, quote, the league's exploding. Franchise values are exploding. Ticket sales, merch, all of it. The players have, this is a really long tweet. But I'll end it with this. Of course they deserve more money. Just the values of the team pay for it without all the other stuff. If somebody told me I could buy a Boston team for $250 million, I would do it without blinking. That's all you got to know about the WNBA finances. Guys, I work at The Athletic. So this is I'm not giving up company
Did
secrets.
Did you know Joe writes for The Athletic?
Thank you. Yeah, this has all been reported publicly. Okay, The Athletic was started in January of 2016. Adam and Alex, great job. Love those guys. They've sold it by now to the New York Times. Well, 2016 is when we started. As has been reported publicly, like we just got profitable not too long ago. It's been, you know, several years to get there. Those guys had to go out and get some big names early to give, you know, to help the company in the early stages get legitimacy. I have an idea of what some of them make. We did not wait for profitability to pay people who make revenue and pay them what they're owed. This is one of the dumbest conversations I've ever heard. And if you're still screaming about them losing money, please take a second to read a book or, God, go away.
I'm with you. I think it's stupid.
Long fuse.
It's stupid to say that they don't deserve more money. Obviously, they deserve more money. The one thing over the weekend that bothered me was the Kelsey Plum thing where she kind of tried to throw Caitlin Clark under the bus. I'm like, as much as I...
Well, that was like Team Clark wasn't there, right?
Yeah, she's like, it was a special moment for all of us to put these shirts on and make a statement. There weren't many members of Team Clark that were in there. I'm like, I understand that, you know... I'm sure
that was bizarre.
A lot of the players probably do hate that Caitlin Clark draws all the headlines. And it's like, there are so many great players in that league outside of Caitlin Clark that just don't get enough attention. I mean, Asia Wilson has been the best player in that league for a long time and doesn't get enough attention. So I understand that, but also Caitlin Clark is a large reason why the fandom is growing.
Sure. I mean, I would say she's number one. She's not solo, but she's number one.
Right. I'm not saying these players need to kneel at her feet and bow and say, thank you, Caitlin, for bringing us all this attention.
Don't start another rant.
But it's like, you do have to agree that Caitlin Clark is a large reason why there are new fans getting into the WNBA.
Of course.
So I think you need to embrace her. You don't have to worship her if you're these WNBA players.
No, you're trying to beat her every night.
Right, beat her every night, but also understand that a lot of your leverage when it comes to these negotiations does start with Caitlin Clark. And the new generation of players that are coming, like Paige Becker's getting drafted this year, draws a lot of eyes. Juju Watkins will be the same way when she comes out.
Right.
So I think that they're going to do very well for themselves in this negotiation. And they should. But you have to understand as these players, like, hey, don't hurt yourself in these negotiations by, you know, you've got, not to say the golden goose, but like Caitlin Clark has this large effect that has allowed the league to grow exponentially in the last 2 years. Don't go after her and say that she's not helping you out with this movement when she is a large reason why you were able to get so far in these negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the Kelsey Plum thing was dumb. That was bizarre. Okay, here we go. Joe, you need a lesson on economics. No one cares about the WNBA. So again, the facts that I just told you, the $2.2 billion media rights deals is going to get to about $2.5 billion. The franchise valuations that are collectively $3.5 billion, that are $269 million apiece. Someone who's very rich, who I believe him, he would buy a Boston franchise right now. No one cares about WNBA. You sure about that?
Yeah, you got a lot.
I need a lesson in economics. Who needs a lesson in economics?
You've got a lot.
Give me your name so I can scream at you.
Really smart people are trying to buy into the WNBA right now. Like, really smart rich people are trying to buy into the WNBA. Right. I think that deserves at least a little bit of credit that the league is going in the right direction.
Might mean something. I don't know. Call me crazy. All right, we come back. We will get back into the Titans, and we are going to get into Brian Callahan. He talks next hour. We're going to carry the beginning of that presser too, but we're going to get into a little bit of Berserker and Brian Callahan and that relationship as they enter this critical year. Robbie and Rex are 102.5, 106.3 The Game.